This podcast is brought to you by the Clare and Gilbert Valleys Council. Welcome to another episode of the Clare Valley Podcast, bringing you the latest news, views and events from the Clare and Gilbert Valleys Council area. I'm your host, Annabelle Homer. Coming up, you'll hear all about Taylor's Wine's multi-million dollar investment in a new cellar door. It was launched only this month, and what a sophisticated and beautiful development. Not only is it a proud moment for Taylor's, but also a great boost for the Clare Valley wine and tourism industry as a whole.
Wow, we've got to do it now. Like, where other people are doing great stuff in the valley, and we, you know, we got to be in it. You got to be in it to win it. So we needed to do something. So this is it.
But first, to the latest from Council Headquarters, I'm joined by Council CEO, Dr. Helen McDonald. Dr. Helen McDonald, thank you very much again for your time and taking the time to talk to me today.
You're welcome.
The Riverton Community Hall consultation outcome. I understand that there was consultation taking a look at the community's views on whether funds should be directed to the Riverton Community Hall refurbishment or the Gilbert Valley's community complex. What was the response from the community?
I think we can safely say that the resolution that Council made in July, I think it was, to ask the Riverton community what their views were about where they wanted the money spent, basically created some outrage, because the community centre is merely a thought that has been discussed to a very limited extent by the Riverton community, and they didn't appreciate being asked to make a choice between an existing building which is quite heavily used and a concept that's floating around. So they had a petition which they submitted to council saying that. So
249 signatories.
Yes, and it's good that the community made its views known, and so council decided that it would go back out for consultation and ask the community in terms of the concept designs that we have for doing the renovations or refurbishment of the Riverton Town Hall, and, you know, what would the community actually like to happen in that space. So that was the decision that council ended up making.
Now, local roads and community infrastructure program, the Australian government has committed an additional $250 million to phase four of this particular program. That's on top of the previously announced $500 million, which takes the total commitment from the Australian government to the program to $3.25 billion. Now, I understand the council's been allocated certain amounts, $477,275 for approved local road and community infrastructure projects, as well as $275,302 for approved road projects. Now, the applications have been open since July, and the projects are required to be delivered by June 2025. A lot of money thrown around here, Helen. So who is benefiting from this funding?
There's playgrounds expansion at Watervale, there's street planting for Clare, Riverton, Auburn and Saddleworth, there's the removal of the soft fall at the Stockport playground, and obviously replace that soft fall, improved disability car parks for both Clare and Riverton, removal and replacement of trees and fixed footpaths at Auburn, improvements for the Watervale Grandstand, which is the most gorgeous little building.
It is.
It's and gorgeous. Really would be sad if we didn't maintain that. And there's also the Riverton RSL History Room building that needs some work done. That's the suggestions for the funding.
So how did these projects come to be? Did the community come to you with these proposals?
No, they're just projects that quite a few of them are on our open space strategy. So they're particular infrastructure that we have known is needed to be either fixed, upgraded or constructed in the first instance. We always have more things to do than we have funds to do. So it's never hard for us to identify opportunities to invest in, and we try to basically spread that funding across all the communities so that benefit just doesn't land in one place.
And you mentioned that a lot of funding goes into roads. I understand that there's few roads that you're going to fix up with this funding as well.
Yes, I think there's a total of six roads that are actually listed in our current annual business plan that we have identified that we could use this funding for. However, That doesn't mean we're diminishing council's funding into roads. A number of other roads that had been identified that had needed work, but we didn't have enough funding within our own budget to do those capital works. We'll pull those in now and do those. So the total number of roads that will be done or plan to be done will be increased.
Interesting that this is quite significant funding, as you've mentioned, but I understand with most grants you require a minimum 50% co-contribution, but for this one there is no contribution at all by council.
No, that's the wonderful thing. It's a large part of this program actually was because of COVID, so it was part of a process, I think, to try and kickstart the anticipation that the economy was going to be in a fairly sad place post or during and post COVID. So that funding was directed towards local government to put back into the community in terms of contractors, etc.
Some of the roads that will be improved with this funding will be Marildon Road at Mintero, Mount Horrocks Road at Watervale, Old Blythe Road at Baconic Park, Polish Hill Road at Polish Hill River, Square Mile Road at Stanley Flat, and Baconic Park Road at Baconic Park. If you'd like to find out more specifics about those road upgrades, head to the Clare and Gilbert Valleys Council's website and click on their minutes. Residential Land Development Incentive Scheme. I understand this is a scheme to encourage developers to undertake development on a meaningful scale. So this is in light of the fact that there is a housing shortage in the Clare and Gilbert Valley area. And this is just one thing that the council is proposing to get developers to come here and to develop significantly in the area. So what's this scheme all about?
There were two things that happened at the council meeting. One, we, in light of the decisions that council took at a previous council meeting with respect to incentives for housing development, we needed a policy, so we needed council to sign off on that policy. But we also identified that council needed to consider expanding those incentives, because when we looked at it, we didn't think there was enough in it to really incentivise a developer. So we put up the suggestion or recommendation to council that they include in that incentive scheme the forgiving removal of the amount of money that has to be paid into the wastewater system. So basically any new development, you have to make a contribution to that scheme, which is part of investment for capital development in the future, both replacement and potential expansion. So the suggestion has been was to council, which they decided, was to remove that contribution where a developer was going to do more than five developments. So it's not available to a single development, but if there's somebody's looking at doing five or developing five allotments, then they would be eligible to have that investment removed, but it would be capped at 10. Well, if they have five allotments, they'd be having to make, if they had to pay the contribution, it would be $25,000. So that's along with the other incentives that council agreed to before. I think there's potential if they were doing five allotments, they'd have a saving of over $30,000. So not a huge saving, but just a small incentive.
So if the developer isn't paying for that, then is it the ratepayer that's going to be?
Yes, it does. That's right. It's a subsidy that is made by existing ratepayers, yes. Mm.
How do you think that's going to be met by ratepayers?
Oh, look, I'm sure that some would not like that idea at all. Others will recognise the advantages, probably particularly business people who can't get employees because they can't get accommodation.
Would ratepayers notice a significant increase in their rates because of this scheme?
No. I doubt it. Because of the economics of doing developments in regional areas, we rarely ever attract any of the big developers who do really big estate development. Because if they can do developments closer to Adelaide or Mount Barker, etc., they will do that because they make more money. Coming into the regions is kind of like the last resort. It's something that's probably, it's going to be at the small end.
Yeah.
If we manage to get, one or two people taking advantage of this, that would be great.
And are other regions doing this, providing these incentive schemes to developers?
I certainly know that Wakefield have looked at it because they have significant issues in terms of housing for of the development that's going on over there. I certainly know other councils are looking at various schemes. Mm. We're all doing the same thing. Not sure that at the end of the day that's going to help us find any more developers, because the building industry is, you know, there's only so many operators in there. There's only so many tradies. Mm. And yeah, and there's also the shortage in terms of materials coming in from overseas, and that may have been alleviated a bit, but it's an ongoing kind of issue that the whole housing industry has.
And so council has supported this scheme at the last meeting?
Yes.
So what's the next step then?
The next step is we wait and hopefully somebody will take advantage of it.
The Saddleworth Institute Revocation of Community Land Report. So a lot of chat about land in this episode. So I understand that the Saddleworth Institute Committee is wanting to look at the pros and cons of leasing the building. Why have they decided to go down this track?
I think there always seems to be some kind of fear that if a building is sold, then it's not going to be looked after and will no longer be an asset to the community. Obviously, if it's sold, it's unlikely to be a building that's accessible by the community. However, there's plenty of examples throughout the valley where public buildings have been sold and the people that purchased them have made significant investment and they essentially become a visual asset. Some people, because they talk about that and they recognise that that would be a good thing, but others don't. They kind of get outraged that an asset which they see as theirs is going to be sold. Council can't keep every asset that's ever built over the generations. It's just, it becomes a maintenance and a cost burden to council.
So if the community leases the building off council,
yes,
is it the community's responsibility to maintain the building?
Yes.
As part of that?
Yes.
Okay, which, again, that's the costly part of
exactly
having the building.
Yeah, and that was another decision that council made in terms of the process of gifting, selling, leasing, is that if any member or community wanted to lease the building or have it gifted, then it comes as is. Council would not be providing any funds either in the transfer of the building or in the future to maintain that building.
So the community will be paying a leasing fee plus doing all the maintenance?
All of our leases are essentially peppercorn leases. That will not be a cost to the community. So if they're used for a community activity, then it's a peppercorn lease. So they won't have to come up with a lease fee. They'll just have to find funds to maintain the building.
Moving on to the Auburn Library, again, a revocation of community land, and there's been some consultation in regards to that process. Apparently there were no submissions from the public to revocate the community land status for the Auburn Library. So what's the next step for the Auburn Library?
So that's part of the process of the library being gifted to the Auburn community. That's the direction that they want to go in. They want to keep that as an asset for their community. Part of that process, we have to change it from being community land to being freehold land so that they can do whatever they desire.
And that takes a couple of years, does it?
Yes, it's a long, slow process, essentially because things sit on ministers' desks for extended periods of time. So there's always this consultation part too, so that always adds the time which it takes to deal with these issues.
Councillor David Wilson brought up a proposal to reopen Neagle's Rock Road between Essington Avenue and Henry Street. What's the background to this proposal?
Well, I think the desire is for Neagle's Rock Road to be open all the way. Currently, yes, it's closed between Essendon Avenue and Henry Street, and that was a consequence of, I'm not sure when, but quite some time ago, probably a good 20 or 30 years ago, there was a serious accident, and I think the council at the time decided to close that road so it could not be used as a racing track, shall we say. However, Councillor Wilson was of the view that it would be good if it was opened, so basically that motion was proposed to council, but unfortunately it didn't get up. The status quo will remain, that road won't be opened. Actually, the third time a motion has been put up since the road has been closed, and it's happened twice since I've been here, so that's twice in the last five and a half years that a councillor has put forward a proposal to open that particular part of the road. And
why do they want it open again?
Well, Councillor Wilson argued that for tourism purposes, but also for safety purposes, that it should be open. So my understanding is the CFS and ambulance would appreciate that was open. I think ambulance in particular have wasted time thinking they could get through and unable to. So that's one reason. I'm not aware of any of the residents that are actually impacted by that road closure. They certainly haven't lobbied council to ask for it to be open. And I'm not sure whether they have or haven't lobbied any of the individual councillors.
Why was it rejected? Do they still think it's a safety issue?
I think, yeah, there's a fear that it's a safety issue, even though the proposal was to have traffic calming infrastructure in place so people could not use it as a... You could get through, but you couldn't do it at speed. If it had been open, we'd put a number of traffic calming devices, not just in the area that currently is closed, but we'd probably put a couple of others in just to really reduce that potential of people speeding through that area.
The Clare Valley has a long-standing relationship with Bizen in Japan, and it's 33 years since that partnership was established. A monument was erected outside the council chambers recently to recognise and celebrate this partnership.
The deputy mayor from Bizen amazingly travelled from Bizen to Clare, was here for less than 24 hours, looked incredibly perky, fell in love with the Clare Valley wines, and then travelled back to Japan. But so, yes, it's a celebration of the long-standing relationship. There is now a monument outside the council chambers, which is made from rocks donated by the Clare Quarry and also the Mintero Slate Quarry. It's a bridge. That's the symbol, as the bridge between the two entities. I think having a large rock is also, I understand, a symbol or important feature of many particularly historic Japanese buildings, because historically a great big rock would be outside the residence or the entrance to a particular warlord's residence. And also people are probably familiar with rocks that you often find in Japanese gardens. That's sort of the symbolic part of it, where the two mayors, or the mayor and the deputy mayor, made speeches about the relationship and et cetera with all the students from Japan. But also we had students from St Joseph's and also from the Clare Primary School and the Clare High School. The Clare High School students looked very, very dashing in their formal attire, I have to say. They really dressed up for the occasion, so it was lovely. It was lovely to see.
Also celebrations in the wine industry recently, with Taylor's Wines opening up their magnificent multi-million dollar cellar door development.
Yes, yes. This is certainly what we've been aware, because we deal with development approvals, but been aware of this project for probably a couple of years now. Yes, and it's great to see that something that was really initiated during COVID has been pursued through to development, and even during these rather tough economic times. And yes, it really is a lovely building that they have for their cellar door and for future events. And so, yes, that's quite an important moment, I think, particularly for Taylor's, which is probably our largest winery. I mean, it's wonderful for Taylor's that they have that facility now available to them. It's very sophisticated but understated. I think that's how I would put it. Really interesting, lovely use of wood and stone, and some really unusual tiles that they've used on feature walls and on a lovely fireplace that they have there. So
can't wait to go and check it out. Sounds beautiful.
Well, I think it's beautiful. Between the architect and the interior designer, I think they've done some lovely work.
Well, thank you, Helen, again, for keeping us up to date with all the latest happenings at council headquarters. And I'll catch you again at the next council meeting, which isn't that far away. So thank you.
No, they come round very fast.
Well, I couldn't wait. Right after my interview with Helen, I jumped in the car and headed straight to Taylor's Wines. I wanted to check this state-of-the-art cellar door out for myself, and I 100% agree with Helen. It exudes absolute sophistication. From Taylor's iconic three seahorse emblem on arrival, The main tasting room adorned with a bronze green tiled circular fireplace. The private collector's club room with 180 degree views over the expanse of lawns and the courtyard with its stone fireplace. This cellar door represents the winery's first major hospitality revamp, a space that Taylor's is truly proud of and has been years in the making. To get the true essence as to how important this development is to the Taylor family and the company, you need to know firstly the history and how Taylor's Wines came to be in the Clare Valley in the first place. General Manager Clinton Taylor says it all started with his grandfather back in 1969.
We were hoteliers in Sydney and we were sourcing wine from a few regions, but the Clare Valley being one, and from the local grower cooperative, the Clare Vale Grower Cooperative primarily. And we got out of hotels, but through sourcing the wine for the hotels, we thought, wow, how great the region was and the wine that was being produced, and thought, why don't we give that a go? So that was in 1969 that we bought land here in Auburn and went about planting Cabernet and Shiraz primarily. And at the time, a lot of people thought, wow, that's going to make a lot of fortified wine. But little did they know, we were going to make table wine. And then we invested in sales teams. So my grandfather and his two sons really did back the vision that they had and put a lot into it. And we sort of got up and running because we then, as I said, we planted vines, built the winery, and then also a few years later got a sales team in place. And
so during the 70s would have this been?
Yeah, early 70s, yes. Good timing as people were, the wine appreciation was evolving in Australia. So that really helped us to be positioned well and tell the stories. And we've always... A big win for us, we entered in the national shows around Australia and we won the Montgomery Trophy in Adelaide. And we put that on our label and we found that really helped us get our name out and sales, and we've done it ever since, really. And so that's the thing we do.
Well, obviously, your first time dabbling in wine, like the Taylor's family.
Yeah.
I know it's your grandfather and sons that started it. When did you get on board?
When did I get on board? I've been on board for more 20-something years now. I worked outside of the industry initially, but I've worked in sales for Taylor's and got an appreciation there. But then always thought I'd like to be, I like the land and being around the sort of manufacturing side of things. So I gradually sort of morphed, if you like, to going from sales to having involvement over here in Auburn. And this is our main holding of vineyard is here in Auburn. So, yeah, over my journey, I've sort of moved a bit in the company and I've been in this role for like 10 years now.
So you'll say this is the main holding. Where else do you have?
We've got a vineyard in Rattenbully where we've got a bit of red wine there, Cabernet and Shiraz primarily. And we're still Taylor's. We're predominantly red wine and most of our sales are domestic. We make great Chardonnay, award-winning. We've won gold medals in recent years in France for our Chardonnays, so we're super proud of that. So that's one thing you got to, anyone listening out there, don't just try the reds. The whites are really good. Our Riesling, obviously from Clare, we're very proud of, but the Chardonnay is really good too.
Yeah. How many acres or how much do you produce now?
Yeah, well, we're about, what are we, sort of 1,200 acres here under vine. You know, we sell a good few hundred thousand cases sort of a year.
And you're the biggest employer in the Clare Valley, aren't you?
Yeah, I think so. We've got about 90 sort of full-time employees here. So we probably, what makes us a bit bigger in the region is we've got a bottling line here. So we bottle all our product, and that helps with quality. So we've got a lot of the vineyards probably are about 35-40% of what we need to fulfill all our products that we have. But that we've got some great quality aspects that we, you know, can bring it in straight away to our cellar and start making wine. And then with bottling, we don't have to move it off-site. We bottle here too.
Is that common?
Probably not. So there's not many bottling, not any other producers in Clare, for instance, have a bottling line.
What about in the Barossa and, you know, those sort of bigger wine regions?
There's probably been more consolidation of it over the years. So, it's some of the sort of medium-sized companies like the likes of Brown Brothers or De Bortley, I think they have bottling lines. Not everyone has a bottling line. And
sounds quite exclusive, really.
Yeah, well, we looked at it. I mean, we did look at it and think, should we do it? But we thought the quality side of things, and it also gives us the ability to be quick to market. If we have a good idea and we're getting on with a retailer and they want to do something, we can make it happen pretty quick. So that was an aspect that got it over the line.
Do you bottle other people's wines here as well, or is it just solely Taylor's wines
just solely?
Not good sharers.
No, right. Well, it gets mentioned at times that maybe we should look at that, but that's the wine game's pretty complex as it is, and adding that to it, I'd go a lot greyer than what I already am currently. So, but hey, you never know.
You've just invested a multi-million-dollar investment into a brand new state-of-the-art cellar door. Years in the planning, I understand, and it's finally been launched. How are you feeling?
Look, really super proud, like really proud, because we think it's a great facility, and it sort of talks to our brand and what it's like one of the last sort of pillars of what we're aiming to do at Taylor's, which is continually improve and make better wine, take it to the world and around Australia. We invested a lot behind the walls of the winery. So we mentioned a bottling line and barrel halls and barrels and things along those lines. So we made sure that we were doing our best to make great wine. And then this really caps off the ability to the public, but bring in retailers or journalists and show them, you know, the essence of how proud and serious we are and what we are. It's showing a bit of essence of our brand and us as a family.
So when people walk through the doors of the cellar door, what did you want to ignite, I guess, with your customers coming through?
We've got a lovely space here, so we wanted to – there's great aspects all around us. You can see vineyard in different areas. We want to greet people, have them sit, stay, spend some time. So with all the views that we've got, that's important. They can look up to the winery, and it's – you know, it's pretty iconic. It's a bit, sometimes, you know, we go, oh, is it a bit daggy? It's like a castle. But, you know, I think it's come around. For me, it's come around. It's sort of like, cool. It's gone past daggy and it's cool. So you can have great views of it and you're in a beautiful space. Like we're here in a courtyard. There's two courtyards. There's the indoor area. There's a log fire. There's a gas fire. There's beautiful high ceilings that sort of give a barn sort of feel, so tie in a bit there with the country. We've got lots of stone that sort of talks a little bit to how, you know, we've got our emblem is three seahorses, and we found fossilised seahorses in the dam that we excavated just over 200 metres away from where we're talking.
Right.
So there's that little sort of feel for us. And like we're here together, Annabelle, on a beautiful day, and it's just beautiful to sit outside or inside, have views, try fine wine in a really lovely, beautiful setting. And there's lots of, you know, the tiling and the wood at the counter. There's lots of great, great aspects to the cellar door.
The products that you used, have you stayed local?
We've done a bit of both. So the stone that we're looking at, that's actually imported stone from Italy. Oh. But we've done another thing I'm excited about is the entrance. So we've got a lot of stone from the property, or well, that's all stone from the property for the entrance gates and things like that. We've never done that. I dare say we should have done that earlier, like things like a nice entrance, but we, as I said, invested elsewhere. That's all local stone.
I'll tell you what, when I rocked up, it just exudes sophistication.
Yeah.
And I'm just a general customer. I've gone to cellar doors. Yeah. I live in the Clare Valley. I know what they're like, but I just feel that wineries in the Clare Valley are really stepping up a notch, and they're really trying to attract that higher end customer. And I guess that's where you're coming from too. You're trying to attract that higher end customer.
Yeah, definitely. And we wanted to be slightly different and sort of and sophisticated. I think that's a good word you use. So we collaborated, myself and Justine, my wife, Justine Taylor. We sort of talked, and she had a bit of a vision. So she got a sort of pictorial stuff of some of the quite a few American wineries that we sort of just liked the look of. And then we collaborated with Christina and Greg Pulford from Greg Pulford Architectures here in Clare. and got on sort of the same page there. And then we've used for interior Georgie Shepherd from Adelaide, who's a great interior designer. And that was really good. We sort of got, I think everyone got on board and understood what the vision was and liked it and went, we can do something here, and sort of away we've gone. So really happy with how it's come together. And, yeah, trying to be a bit slightly different but sophisticated. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Who pretty much said, okay, it's time now, we've got to do something about it. Who's
idea? I'm gonna take credit for that. I went far out. We've got to, for what we're doing as a business, we've got to have more of a front end, a home. I like to call it a home for our wines. Like they get made up in front of us at the winery, but now they've got a home for people to try, taste, and really enjoy. So,
and you've got the total experience now.
Yeah, what we're having. You know, people can, you know, potentially on the weekends have a tour up top and have a look around, and then come down and sit down and really enjoy the wine. So, yeah, I'll put my hand. I just went, wow, we've got to do it now. Like where other people are doing great stuff in the valley, and we, you know, we got to be in it. You got to be in it to win it. So we needed to do something. So this is it.
Well, thank you so much for spending the time with me too, and in the beautiful courtyard, just looking at this beautiful cellar door. And you must be pretty stoked that it's all done and dusted, as in you finally got the total masterpiece complete.
Yeah.
But I know you have to head off to Sydney, so I appreciate your time. So thank you.
No, pleasure. Nice to talk to you with Annabelle. And it's super exciting for us, and it's a really proud moment for us. Come along, people. Come and check it out. You're welcome.
As Clinton mentioned, this project was a collaboration between GP Architects, Cook Building, and Georgie Shepherd Interior Design.
Christina Soggy, Senior Project Architect.
Now, you've been working on this particular project for 4 to 5 years?
Yep. Yeah, pretty much.
How are you feeling now it's all complete?
Excited. Also a weird sense of loss because, you know, after working on something so intently for so many years and then having it done and not seeing those people every day, not being at the place every day, not thinking about it every day, it's a very strange sense of loss, but very excited to see the vision come to life. And it's a multitude of emotions.
It's a long time to work on a project. It would be like your baby as such.
Yeah.
As an architect, when you're approached to do a project like this and then you've seen the end product, is it pretty much on par with what you expected?
This one, weirdly, yes. Yeah, sometimes you get projects and you go in with all these different ideas and the end product changes over the course of time. But this one, Taylors came to us and said what they wanted, and it was a very difficult brief to work with. There was a lot involved that they wanted us to achieve. But
what was the brief?
There are two levels to it. One was functionality, so what they wanted the building to service. So it was, we've got the original homestead, which they wanted to be able to incorporate into the design and have that as a functionality part for offices and meeting room, and keep part of it as a flat for one of the tailors to come and stay whenever they're in town. And then add on, have storage facilities for the wine, and then also cellar door function, which has a function space as well, so that they could run the cellar door at the same time as having a function, so a wedding or events. And they wanted to incorporate the existing site into everything. So you had all of those purposes that they needed, so a multi-purpose facility that they needed to achieve, but then they also wanted it to be something unique, something that represented the brand, the Taylors, because they're a family, so it felt homely, but also something that was representative of the region that we live in, because it is beautiful and we have the vineyards, the cropping lands, the agriculture, just the rolling hills, the materials, everything. They wanted it to be a reflection of all of those things combined.
Where do you start, honestly?
Exactly. Exactly. You just kind of block everything out, I guess, and say, these are the things they need, what sort of spaces you need, how is it going to interact with the existing building, because we had an existing building to work from. So that kind of governed how and where things moved. Yeah, and then you just kind of start nutting out the details and it just evolves as time goes past. And I guess with materials, I honed back into one of the original stories that Taylors told me, was when they first came to the site, they dug a dam, and when they were digging the dam, they found they had the limestone, and they found these fossilized seahorses. So we wanted to use a limestone product that had sort of fossilizations and coral-like features to it. So that was always something that I really wanted to draw on, reflect the materials of the existing homestead, which was this beautiful stone as well, and then have it so it felt very earthy and organic, really robust, strong materials like timbers and stone that reflected, you know, everything around it as well. So
Clinton mentioned he got the stone, or you got the stone from Italy.
Yes.
So that's the fossilised stone?
Yes.
Yes. Yep. So where else did you source materials from?
So we have the pavers, both internally and externally in some places. They're all from Morocco. Again, we chose sort of sandstone, limestone, travertine materials that were all in keeping with what we can get locally. We wanted the colours and materials to be reflective of what we have here, but we couldn't get here. And then we also had the travertine, which was from Greece. So a few of those materials from those places. But then timber, we tried to source as locally as possible. So we used a lot of silver top ash, Oregon, natural Australian timbers.
Was it difficult to do all this during COVID? Because I presume that's when you were building it.
Yes. So the design stage was mostly during COVID, and then build, we were still having issues, supply issues for materials. So a few of the original items that we'd selected, we couldn't get, or we had significant lead times on. So with the builder, we worked very closely to organise. The tailors basically paid up front for materials so that they could order them and avoid any of the delays that other building projects have had. So it was a weird one to negotiate, because we've, like everyone, we've never had to negotiate COVID before or any of that. So yeah, just trying to work the best that we possibly could to keep the project running and be adaptable when things didn't go our way.
A lot of people who've been already to the cellar door always talk about your circular tiled fireplace. There's the collector's room, which is quite special.
Yep.
You've got the pavilion as well, and you've got the outdoor patio, you've got your actual cellar door. There's so many facets, as you've already mentioned. From what you worked on, Christina, what was your highlight? What did you specifically like about the cellar door?
I had always wanted to do a curved fireplace, and I basically... it's a labour of love, that one. I just turned around to the tailors really early on and said, can I do this? And they're like, oh, why not? Let's give it a go. And I was like, most people avoid curves because they're painful, and it was painful to construct. But we think it's the only one in the Southern Hemisphere. So we wanted something unique. And every time I look at it, I just think it kind of gives me chills, because it's exactly what I envisioned it to be, basically. So, but yeah, I think the other facet is just how connected it is to the site. So no matter where you are standing, you can see the tailor's facade, the old castellations, the iconic facade.
You're talking about the castle?
The castle, yep. And then you see the homestead, you see the lawns, you see the sculptures that they have. That was part of what I really wanted to make sure, is that no matter where you were, you see everything. And I think that's totally been achieved, and I love that we nailed that one on the head. So yeah, those two are probably my things that I love the most. We tried to create spaces so that no matter who you are, where you're from, you can come and feel comfortable. You have the Collectors Club, which is the high-end special room that people can go and do special tastings. You've got the patio, so you can go with a family and your kids can play on the lawn. It's dog friendly, so depending on the season, you can go and sit in the courtyard and the fireplace, or no matter where you are, you can, you've got spaces to enjoy. So anyone can go.
Anyone.
That's the whole point. It's not just a tasting environment. You go for an experience, and you can sit and spend the afternoon.
That's brilliant. Excellent. Well done. It's a beautiful space.
Thank you.
And you're very talented, and congratulations.
Thank you.
That's Christina Soggy, Senior Project Architect with GP Architects. And some other projects Christina has worked on is the Watervale Hotel, Slate Restaurant at Pikes, and also the Clare Valley Sporting Precinct. So she's been one busy girl. And that's a wrap of this latest episode. If you have an event or an issue or a person that's worth being recognised on this podcast, don't hesitate to let me know. For all the latest council news, of course, you can head to the council website and any of their social media pages on Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is brought to you by the Clare and Gilbert Valleys Council. I'm Annabelle Homer. I'll catch you next time.